Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We're going to begin this hour by talking with Dr. Gregory Popchick. As a parent, have you ever felt awkward or unwelcome at Mass because your kids were making too much noise? Church teaching makes it clear your children should be there. This isn't something that's negotiable. It's a big part of the Catholic identity, that children are subsumed into the tradition and the life of their parents. Children, in that sense, don't quote-unquote get an option. And therefore, the church community actually has an obligation to create an accommodating and welcoming environment where young families and young children can thrive and be welcome there. Now, this isn't to therefore say that we can't, as young parents, especially parents of young children, be understanding of the needs of the other faithful as they're praying, but most certainly, the parish must be a home, a spiritual home for all, including the young, so that that young family, that young cohort of children will grow up into mature cohorts of children and youth and eventually young adults and adults who take the faith seriously because they were taught from a young age that this is a part of my life. This is my culture. This is who I am. This is what I do because this is what informs my own family life. So Greg will be talking with us about that. After that, we engage with Dr. Tom McGovern about a medical analysis of Jesus' passion. What Christ suffered during his passion for you and for me is a powerful source of reflection and meditation. And I have personally found that the natural science only greater illuminates the sheer immensity of the suffering of our Savior, especially when you consider the words of St. Thomas Aquinas, borrowing from the plethora of the Church's tradition, that what Christ went through in his body is exponentially worse than anything any human person could ever go through because Christ had perfect senses. And so he felt pain at a more intense level, especially since he was paying for the sins of all the people who had come before him. We talk about all of this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, March 31st. It's the Feast of St. Guy of Pomposa. Today's news brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. Pope Leo XIV's prayer intention for the month of April is for priests in crisis. In a video released today, he invited the faithful to join him in prayer for priests going through moments of crisis and that communities may support them with understanding and prayer. The Supreme Court has ruled in favor of a Colorado Christian counselor who offered conversion therapy services for LGBTQ kids. Counselor Kaylee Childs challenged a state law banning so-called conversion therapy for kids.
The law I'm challenging harms kids and silences speech. Kids deserve real help, affirming that their bodies are not a mistake and that they are wonderfully made.
The justices ruled 8-1 the First Amendment holds the state can't prevent counselors from speaking freely on questions of gender in therapy sessions. President Trump has a message for allies that have not supported the U.S. military operation in Iran. Tony Waterman reports he made the comments in a post on social media.
President Trump told countries running out of jet fuel to either buy it from the U.S. or to, quote, build up some delayed courage and go take it from Iran. He also said countries will have to start learning how to fight for themselves because the U.S. won't be there to help anymore.
The Wall Street Journal reporting that Trump has told aides that he's willing to end the military campaign against Iran, even if the Strait of Hormuz remains largely closed. Wall Street is closing sharply higher to end the month and quarter, stocks jumping in a broad-based relief rally following those new reports that the U.S.-Iran war could be winding down. The three major averages surge after an unconfirmed report saying Iran's president is ready to end the conflict with certain guarantees. The S&P up nearly 3%, the NASDAQ nearly 4%. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm talking with Dr. Gregory Popchick. He and his bride Lisa co-host More to Life, a call-in program produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN, and frankly, one of the fastest hours in Catholic radio that provides helpful advice for families from the perspective of the theology of the body and counseling psychology. They are also the producers of the Catholic HOM network and app. And download it, be a part of the network, and flourish as a family together. Greg, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
So today we are talking about taking your children, your little children, to Mass. I want to ask for you to speak to perhaps the core issue here, which is that children ought to be brought to Mass from a young age to be inducted into the spiritual life of their parents. And all considerations aside, that's a core reality. So I invite you to speak to that first.
Yeah, so I think that there's some thought that somehow children shouldn't be brought to Mass until they're able to really understand what's going on. But I think that really robs them of the opportunity to begin to be socialized to what happens at church. And, you know, that long before children can cognitively appreciate what's going on around them, they are picking up on the rhythms of things and participating in kind of the atmosphere of it all. And, you know, as we bring our children to church, even though it might seem like they're wiggly and they're noisy and they're not getting a lot out of it, what we're doing is we're creating, if you will, we're sort of creating a folder in their brain where we can download over time the information about how do we behave there and what do we get out of it and how can we learn from the experience, as opposed to just sort of waiting until we think that the children are, you know, old enough, quote unquote, to really understand it, and then trying to do it, because then we're trying to do too much at once, right? We're trying to create that folder all at the same time while filling it, you know, with information. And I think that it's much better to really start early. And in fact, you know, once children are baptized, they belong. You know, they are part of God's family, and so it's important to really include our children.
We can also acknowledge that there is a threshold. It's not like, I'm a father of little children, and so I want to be the first to acknowledge that being silent and sitting still for over an hour at Mass is a challenge for young children. So there is a threshold here between the parental responsibility, but also a spirit of accommodation, and it works in hand with each other. Can you please speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that making sure that we're able to adjust our focus. I mean, I think one of the things, Mark, is that the parents struggle with, you know, is that I hear a lot of times from parents saying that, well, when I brought my kids to Mass, I didn't get anything out of it. You know, it's hard.
Ooh.
Right? And I think that what we need to realize, and I heard Father Mike Schmitz talk about this, and I thought this was particularly beautiful. He said, you know, Mass is ultimately about offering sacrifice. And the sacrifice that we can offer as parents is realizing that the thing we get out of Mass is helping our kids learn to get something out of Mass. You know, there are other ways for us to attend to our spiritual needs. And you know, making it all about, well, just this one, you know, this 1 hour or so on Sundays is the only way I'm going to get myself fed, is missing the point. Mm-hmm. That really, you know, when we're bringing our children to Mass, the real joy is, what can I do to help my children learn to get something out of this? And so if that becomes my focus, instead of how do I shut them up? How do I keep them still? How do I stop them from, you know, so that I can get something out of this? Then I'm able to really enter into a different kind of experience of the Mass, where I'm starting to learn to see it through their eyes, and I'm starting to learn to see, you know, how can I really help them fall in love with Christ and with the Church, and really use this time for that. And I think that becomes a much more rewarding experience then.
Can you also speak to the fact that what we think the children get out of Mass sometimes differs from what they actually get out of it, and therefore readjusting our expectations is also crucial?
Well, that's right. You know, and so that's what I was talking about with, in terms of, you know, seeing it through their eyes, mm-hmm. is really important. And so I think that requires a little bit of preparation at home, too. You know, so, for example, reading children's Bible versions of the Sunday Mass readings can be very helpful. Doing things like identifying a word that maybe occurs through a couple of different readings, or maybe two words that I didn't that occur throughout the Mass, that we can kind of make the word of the week, you know. And when they hear that word, they just kind of give us a little tug on our sleeve, or they just give us a little pat that says, I'm paying attention, you know. And we can praise them for that paying attention to those things. Finding ways to bring, say, very soft books. There are a lot of like sort of cloth books that have Bible stories. Or even soft toys that are, dolls of the saints, for example, mm-hmm. or other Bible characters that the children can play with in the pew, that we reserve just for Sundays. Like, instead of just bringing whatever their favorite toys are from home, you know, having a special Mass, going to Mass bag that has activities that they only do on Sunday, so that keeps those things special, but they're also religiously oriented, so they can kind of keep on theme even if they're not specifically on topic. That we're creating that atmosphere and that experience for the kids, that this is special, that we have special activities that we do in this special place that we just do at this time, really starts to send that message of how to approach the liturgy and how to think about going to Mass differently than say, this is just another thing that we're going to that we have to get you through.
From there, like you mentioned, there are a few other resources, like a children's missal, a children's Mass book, different things that can help stoke the imagination. So I want to ask if you could also offer some counsel as to how to help build the imagination about Mass, especially over the week preparing for Mass.
Well, I honestly, this is going to be a surprise, but I think that parents who have regular family meals with their children do have a better experience of Mass as well, because we're teaching children to be still and be at the table and participate, for example, in grace and participate in the conversation. Like, there are a lot of families who, during family meals, if the kids get a little wiggly, we just let them down and run around the house. But that doesn't really socialize our kids to kind of learning how to be still and to be part of something that's bigger than them. And I think having those meals, those daily, if possible, dinners together as a family where you pray together and you're talking together and you're helping the kids kind of get through that experience by letting them have other activities that they can do that are appropriate at the table, that allow them to stay there for the entire family meal instead of just whenever they've had a couple of chicken nuggets and then they can get down and run around. I mean, being able to do that is a really important part of it, but also a regular family prayer, so mm-hmm. that we have a daily time of prayer together where we read something from the children's Bible, for example, or the children's missal, or and we talk about that together as a family, and we pray together as a family in ways that really enable us to draw closer to God and to each other through that experience. The making these kinds of sacramental activities part of our family life really help our kids begin to understand that what they're experiencing at Mass is an extension of the way we worship God at home, not necessarily the only way we worship God, and when we leave home, right? So, in fact, the research that we did, I've talked about this on the program before, the study we did of Catholic families who successfully raised all of their kids to a faithful adulthood, the adult children who were part of that study said that a lot of what made Mass and all the other things they did, religious education, stick, mm-hmm. was that they saw it as an extension of what they did as a family. Mm-hmm. That it wasn't the thing that they did when they left. Religion wasn't something they did when they left home. It was something they did at home and then was supported by their participation in Mass or religious education or youth group. Unfortunately, I think for a lot of Catholic families, the opposite is true. That our kids don't experience the faith really at home in any meaningful way. It's another activity that's on the list of things that we do. And that tends to undermine the ability for those activities to actually stick on a personal level. Really, what we do personally, or what we own personally, comes from the relationships that we have in the home and how we live out our faith in the home and how that faith supports those relationships.
Well, Greg, that just about hits the nail on the head, that the intimacy of the family in the expression of faith throughout the week is what overflows into Mass, and children sense that, they understand that. Thank you very, very much for your time, Greg. I greatly appreciate this.
Always a pleasure.
My guest has been Dr. Gregory Popcheck. He and his bride Lisa co-produced the Catholic HOM app, Households on Mission app. Find out how you can immerse your life in faith as a couple into the life of your children so that the whole family is drawn into it and enjoys Mass together. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter. Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. For the remainder of the hour, you and I are going to walk through a medical and spiritual dive of what Jesus underwent in his passion and his crucifixion, what Christ suffered during his passion for you personally. For me personally, is a powerful source of reflection and spiritual meditation. We're joined by Dr. Tom McGovern, who gives us both a medical and spiritual analysis of what he endured for us. Tom is the author of What Christ Suffered, A Doctor's Journey Through the Passion. Tom, it's great to speak with you. How are you?
Thanks. Good to be here.
So I want to open here with this very important conversation about the fact that there is an almost empirical veracity to the sufferings of Jesus that therefore lends further credence to the gospel narrative. This isn't some kind of a mystical, mythological religion. It's grounded in a tremendous amount of historical and even medical truth.
Right. I mean, Catholicism is an incarnational religion. It depends on specific things that happen to specific people at specific times and places. And for Jesus, a specific place was Jerusalem, Calvary, which was actually a spent limestone quarry, so that the stone the builders rejected, they couldn't get good stone out of it, is where he died. And it was probably April 3rd, A.D. 33 is the most likely date, which happens to be a First Friday, mm-hmm. which is probably one origin for the First Friday devotion to the Sacred Heart.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. That's news to me. I will say devotions are one of those areas that continue to fascinate me. I'm still a relatively young convert. I'm, 14, sure. Going on 15 years now. Now, that being said, I want to open our conversation. We've been talking a lot about the question of suffering this week because yes. You can't talk about Holy Week without acknowledging this reality. So let's continue to grapple with this. We sure. have a kind of universal aversion to the notion of suffering. So, and you make clear, even the apostles didn't want to think about Christ's suffering, and yet this right. was the path that Christ wanted to use.
It was. Well, indeed. I mean, we talk about the passion. Passion comes from a Latin verb meaning to suffer. Mm-hmm. And it, look, in the Garden of Gethsemane, he even feared the physical suffering he was going to have. He didn't want to go through it. But he immediately said, okay, I don't want to do this if it's possible, but if I have to do it, Father, I'll do your will. So I think Jesus can relate to all of us in the fact that we want to avoid suffering, mm-hmm. and we should avoid avoidable suffering. Some is not, but some is.
Right, exactly. Some is not, but some really is. And so suffering is a reality of the human existence. There's a distinction between pain and real suffering, but any suffering can have a redemptive quality when unified with Jesus's undergoing of suffering on the cross.
Well, that's the beautiful thing. I've written a course for medical professionals based on John Paul II's document, Salva Fici Dolores, mm-hmm. on the Christian meaning of human suffering. And that is right in the title. That is the meaning of suffering. The meaning of suffering is redemption. It is salvation. And as I say in my talks, that suffering and love are actually two sides of one coin, the coin of free will. God wants us to love, but to love, we have to choose to love him, which means we can choose not to love him, which therefore can lead to suffering. So it's a package deal this side of heaven.
So what you're saying is I can't say I'm a loving person if I'm not willing to undergo suffering.
Right. Well, even Bob Marley, remember the philosopher? No, he was a reggae musician, right? He said, you know, you're going to suffer. You just got to find the ones worth suffering for. And that's true. In fact, one of my favorite lines that is in my book, which came out of other people much smarter than me, was that the price of love is suffering. That's right. What love costs.
Yeah. You know, this reminds me of another philosopher, Jagger, who reminds us that you can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, it actually surprises me how secular culture, without meaning to, appeals to these very, very perennial Christian realities, which is, what we want can sometimes destroy us. And so looking at this notion of suffering, we don't want to suffer. We want to avoid suffering, and yet this is the path to become loving and selfless.
Yes. And, you know, one of the favorite things I've learned about suffering is the answer to that great question. Where was God when the blank, when the towers went down on 9/11, when the little kids suffering or that are starving in Africa, where were they? And the great answer is he is inside them, suffering and dying with them.
Yep.
One of the best lines I read during the pandemic was that Christ did not come to take away suffering. Christ did not come to even explain suffering. Mm-hmm. He came to suffer with us. And there is a line in St. Paul's letter to the Colossians where St. Paul says he makes up what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ. And one of the true meanings of that in the church through the years is that his redemption is not complete until he has suffered within every single person what they are suffering with them, and therefore applying the merits of his redemption to them.
And so we can talk about this on a very applied, practical level, too. I mean, I love that your book in Chapter 2 opens up with just the historicity of the event. And so you've got maps, and it presents a very tangible geographical reality of just how much Jesus had to walk, even after being scourged and everything. You get this sense that, wow, this was torture. There's no way around it. This was true physical torture.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And that's why I do that in the book. I've been to the Holy Land 3 times. And so after being there, I mean, that really helps me to bring it home. Mm-hmm. It's not some imaginary thing. It really happened there at that time.
And so let's talk about some of the things that happened. Chapter 3, you open immediately with this question of sweating like drops of blood or sweating blood, which, you know, if you know enough about documentaries, you've heard the term before. But explain to us in greater detail how there's a tremendous anguish and personal connection for us in what Jesus is undergoing.
Okay, so when he's in the garden, one of the things I came across this last year is one of the things he may have been thinking of is he spent many Passovers in Jerusalem. And when you're in there, you see the lambs that are slain. And the lambs are actually crucified. They are put on 2 stakes of wood, one of them going crossways through its shoulders. So he may have had this image as one of the many things going through his mind in the garden. Another thing that I just learned, I just this last weekend read St. Thomas More's The Sadness of Christ, the last thing he wrote before he was beheaded. In there, he points out very well, how do we know Jesus sweat blood? Okay, the apostles, the closest ones to him were a stone's throw. It was night, even though there was a full moon. Could they have seen the sweating blood? Plus, they were sleeping. So he surmises that Christ told them this after his resurrection. He really wants us to know that he sweat blood while he was there face down on that stone. There is a rare medical condition called hematidrosis, sweaty blood. Now, and they've reported in the last 20 years over 60 cases, and I've got pictures of many of these, including the first American reported, and it's amazing. But what comes out of the skin, it can come out of any area of the skin, including areas without sweat glands. So like the tear ducts, the belly button, under the nails, on the tongue. So, and when they've done skin biopsies, there's no connection between blood vessels and the sweat glands, like people surmised years. But in one patient where they did the biopsy while it was happening, it was bizarre. The skin just split open next to where a hair comes out. There are red blood cells out of the blood vessels in the skin, and they're just escaping there. And then these little holes close up that nobody ever sees except in this one skin biopsy. So the sweat and the blood mix on the skin surface, but they do not come out together from the sweat glands. And half of the patients have some kind of extreme thing happen. Like some of the reports are a girl seeing somebody beheaded, or a girl seeing her sister abducted and kidnapped, or some kind of physical abuse. But others happen while they're sleeping. It's really a wide array.
Tom, these breaks hit very fast. We are continuing this conversation with Dr. Tom McGovern, author of What Christ Suffered, A Doctor's Journey Through the Passion. And we want to do a deep dive today so that you and I can greater immerse ourselves spiritually and even mentally in imagination in joining Jesus in his suffering. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter. Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I am talking with Dr. Tom McGovern, author of What Christ Suffered, A Doctor's Journey Through the Passion. And we're talking really about the medical analysis, but also a spiritual insight into what Jesus underwent. So, Tom, I know we can spend a lot of time focusing on one aspect of Jesus' suffering. I want to make a passing statement for you to comment on, and then I want to move on to another area of his suffering.
Certainly.
The fact that you just shared this, because prior to your writing, really, I had been taught a long time ago that the mingling happened in the sweat glands, but what you're sharing now is that blood and water, quite frankly, came forth from Jesus' skin and then co-mingled on the surface, and that seems to lend greater credence to the purification by water and the word by water and the sacrifice of Jesus' blood for the sake of our salvation.
Yes, and in fact, it's kind of a prequel to what would happen on the cross right after he died with the spear from which blood and water came forth. Keeping the sacraments, you know, the blood, the Eucharist, the water of baptism. I had not thought of the sweating blood that way, but I can definitely see the analogy there. Something I'd like to point out with that is that hematidrosis is a high adrenaline state,
right?
Just like when you're in fear or anxiety. But after going through that and allowing himself to feel that fear fully and not trying to escape the fear, for the rest of the Passion, Jesus has risen above everyone around him, and he's just at complete peace, totally focused on doing the Father's will, no more unease or fear at all once he accepts it.
It's profound to think about that the willing embracing of the cross and you know, the drinking of the cup of suffering changes even the human trajectory of participating in suffering. And so to move on from there, then, from the garden, to talk about the sufferings of Jesus in the night as he awaits trial.
Right. So when I went to Jerusalem, I was not aware that they have a place they venerate as the site where Jesus suffered beneath the house of Caiaphas from after midnight until sunrise when he was taken to the temple. And there is what's called the sacred pit there, which has been venerated at least since the 4th century, during the 300s. And there have been four churches built on there. There's another one there, which has not yet been destroyed. French Assumptionists live there. And in this pit, there is a place where they think Jesus was, you know, he was spit on, struck, beaten with fists and open palms. There is also this tradition in Jerusalem. There is a second scourging pillar, or a second pillar, and this one is actually in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in the Catholic chapel part of it. And it, they thought, may have been in the basement of Caiaphas, is where there is a dungeon still today where you can visit. And he may well have been not scourged, but might have been whipped, at least with thin sticks called verga in Latin.
And so tell us a little more about that, because the word that you keep calling him Dr. Luke, rightly so. I actually find that a little amusing throughout your whole book. But he highlights this. His choice of words are very specific here as to a kind of, in this case, dermatological suffering of Jesus.
Right. So he uses a Greek word for the type of suffering Jesus went through that night that none of the other gospel writers use. It's the Greek word derante. So it starts with D-E-R, just like dermis and dermatology for skin. And that word, at least before the time of Christ, had the idea of flaying the skin open. But by the time of Christ, it had undergone a little change, and it just meant to beat the skin pretty severely. And If you look at the Shroud of Turin and believe it's the burial cloth of Christ, I think that's the best explanation for its existence, by the way. There are actually marks on it that would fit being hit with small sticks that you'd be whipped with, very different than with a scourge flagrum instrument. So if he was beaten with that, that wouldn't necessarily draw blood. It could, but it would be incredibly painful while he's up all night. His friends have deserted him. One denies him, although John comes back to follow him. He hasn't slept, hasn't eaten. He's got to be getting worn out already. And then the bloody sweat, would that have made his skin tender? We don't know. Probably not. He lost some fluid, and it probably made him shiver in the cold night, because remember, they had a charcoal fire outside Caiaphas's that night to warm up by.
Yeah. And Tom, this is all preceding the scourging. He hasn't been scourged yet, and he's already undergone a tremendous amount of suffering. So in your book, you highlight how just what he has undergone has put his body in a high tension, high stress, but also high pain state.
Sure, because the more pain you have, the easier it is to feel more pain. I mean, anybody who has experienced a tender area on their body, and anything else that happens seems to be magnified. So this is going to go just multiply for him and cascade.
So we don't often think about this. I think even in most movie depictions, by the time Jesus is brought before trial, so then it's before the scourging, we seem to think, hey, he's relatively okay, you know, he was just incarcerated, but nothing bad had happened yet. But if we read the narrative rightly, he appeared to Pilate already considerably bruised and battered. His skin was inflamed and tender.
Well, just imagine what Caiaphas' guards did to him. It's right there in the Gospels, yet I was one who for decades kind of glossed over that.
Yeah, likewise. And so then he gets, first of all, Pilate goes, you know, like, I'm innocent of this man, scourge him. And so that's the first thing, right? He undergoes scourging at the request of Pilate, but Pilate's being coerced into making this happen. So tell us about what's going on there.
So in Luke and in John, they say that the scourging was done to be the entire punishment, because Pilate intended to release him. So that could explain a more severe scourging, because they wouldn't want to scourge him too much so that they couldn't carry the cross.
Right.
So that might be one thing. So the scourging itself would have been with a weapon similar to some that had been found in the catacombs. It's metal chains, which at the end have little lead balls. Mm-hmm. And they might be round or they might be pear-shaped. And on the Shroud of Turin, they're always paired. And some of the instruments that they found that the Vatican Museums have, which I have not been able to see when I've gone there, but I'd love to, there's over 360 of these marks on the front and back of the body on the shroud. So imagine lead ball hitting you over and over all over your body. Just on the chest, what's that going to do? It can cause so much damage that you start to get fluid and even blood buildup between the lungs and the chest wall. It can actually damage the covering of the heart, the pericardium, so that gets fluid and the heart can't beat as much, the lungs can't breathe in as much, and when you take a big breath, because you've hit the ribs so much, those ribs are tender, and the more they expand and you inhale, the more it hurts. So you don't want to take a big breath, but you need a big breath because you're in so much pain. So it's a catch-22 with the breathing, but you're causing bruising, contusions, and probably if you hit areas over and over, open, bleeding wounds, which may have serum or blood coming out of them all over the body.
And this was designed, these ruling orders of the day, because it started with the Persians, really, that perfected is a terrible way to describe it, the way of crucifixion, but also scourging. And then you see this in different regimes throughout the day. The Babylonians had a different version and whatnot. By the time you come to the Romans, they had mastered a kind of craft of doing this. It was terrible because they knew how to extend the most amount of pain for the longest amount of time without bringing about death, because death had to come by an explicit order.
Correct. That is absolutely right. They wanted to get it bad enough so that by the time the victim got to the upright post to be put on it, they couldn't resist, but they had to be able to make it there. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I agree with that.
So Let's go on from there. Jesus is horrendously scourged. You've appealed to the shroud a few times, so we get a kind of visual of what Jesus is already undergoing. But as you mentioned, two of the Gospels tell us that the intent of Pilate was to scourge and let him go. And
correct.
That doesn't turn out to be the case.
No, because apparently a couple years earlier, he had put up shields, Roman shields, in the precincts where they could be seen with images that violated the Jews. The Jews complained to Rome, and Rome slapped Pilate's hand.
Yeah. We are continuing this conversation with Dr. Tom McGovern about what our Lord and Savior underwent throughout his physical suffering. This is a medical and spiritual meditation and analysis. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter. Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm talking with Dr. Tom McGovern, who is having a conversation with us about the medical and therefore even the spiritual meditation that we can undergo when we think about what Jesus physically went through in his passion and suffering. So, Tom, when we left off, we were talking about the scourging. And so I want to round off that conversation by just acknowledging by this point the effects of the scourging and all of the trauma that Jesus had undergone before. So you mentioned earlier things such as, you know, potential pneumothorax, but pleural effusion, and there's a host of others. So just very briefly walk us through that. And by this point, Jesus's body is under a lot of tension.
Well, he's in a lot of pain, so his heart rate's up, his breathing rate is up, he's lost a lot of fluid, he's going to start to get lightheaded, have trouble focusing and staying upright. And that's going to get compounded with the mocking, which we probably don't have the time to go through, but mm-hmm. having a sharp crown of thorns driven through your head with reeds, which are basically like bamboo poles. So he's going to be in incredible pain, and his body is trying to keep up with its needs with less blood in it than he started with the day before.
So like you mentioned earlier, those thorns are significant and they're part of that royal treatment that you rightly highlight in your
yes.
book. So he's undergoing psychological, deep psychological, emotional, and definitely physiological trauma. And now he's being made to carry the patibulum of the cross from where
yes.
he is to up Calvary.
Right, which is only about 400 meters from Herod's palace, where Pilate was staying, to Calvary, but on uneven streets. And, you know, in the Church of the Holy Cross in Jerusalem and Rome, there are relics reportedly brought back by St. Helena in the 4th century, and one of them is the crossbar, which was assumed to have belonged to the good thief. Whether or not that, they believed it was a crossbar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 6 feet long, about 5 by 2.5 inches in size, and weighs about 15 pounds. But if you have that much pain, you're not seeing clearly, you're dehydrated, and you have it strapped probably with ropes around your arms, because we know that was typically done, it would be easy to lose your balance and fall forward.
Yeah.
And if you look on the Shroud of Turin, there's bigger swelling under the right eyelid than the left. So it's entirely possible that Jesus was listing one way, and when you fall forward, you turn your head to one side, it's probably the right side of his face that mm-hmm. hit the ground. It also shows on the shroud, likely his right shoulder was lower than his left, may have even been dislocated. We don't know, but that's a possibility.
Yeah, yeah. And we also posit that because it is not an uncommon injury to be found amongst records of crucifixion victims.
I don't know that for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised with how hard they were beaten. What's interesting is only one of the Gospels tell us that Jesus carried his cross.
Mm-hmm.
Only John tells us. The other three tell us only that Simon did. But think about it. John was the only one who was probably there. You know,
yeah.
Matthew was probably hiding. Peter, who gave Mark information, was in hiding. And Luke, I don't think, would have been anywhere around there yet. So they heard about Simon and talked about him. But John saw Jesus carries his cross. And it's the only time in literature anywhere where somebody had to have somebody else carry their cross for them. There's
That's
no
right.
other record in literature.
That's right. We don't have another record like that. And so tell us, based on what we know about historical records, about the weight of what Jesus carried.
Well, like I said, the one that is in Rome right now that I've seen and photographed, there's going to be a nice picture of it in my next edition mm-hmm. of the book next year, weighs about 15 pounds. And that's the only piece of evidence we have for what the patibulum, the crossbar, yeah. would have weighed. And there is no example anywhere in literature of anyone ever carrying a two-part cross.
Right.
And there are even inscriptions that give basic instructions for the people that are going to carry this out in Rome. And they had to supply the upright post at the site of crucifixion and then the crossbar that would be carried to the site of crucifixion.
Right. So the steepest would be at the site of the crucifixion, basically awaiting them. So
yes.
Let's move on from there then. Let's talk about his crucifixion proper. So we are Good Friday. He's walked his way despite tremendous trauma all the way
yes.
up Calvary, and now this begins that ordeal of the crucifixion.
Yes. So the word patibulum comes from a verb meaning to stretch out. Mm-hmm. So they would have laid him down on the back of it, probably still roped to him, stretched out his arms, put nails through his wrists, which actually would match history, the earliest images of crucifixion from the 2nd and 3rd century, as well as the Shroud of Turin, used a large spike. It wouldn't have broken any bones. It wouldn't have severed any nerves. It would not have gone through any large blood vessels. And his arms would have been mainly horizontal on that. We do not know how they put people on the cross. But on that crossbar, that patibulum that's in Rome, there's a 1-inch diameter hole right in the center of it.
Mm-hmm.
I just noticed that, my last time there 2 years ago. And so this may well have gone on some spike protruding from the top of the stipes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that, but that's entirely possible. And then how did they fix his feet? There are now 3 archaeological finds of heel bones, 2 with nails and 1 with a hole in the same location. 2 of them going from the outside of the heel in, 1 going from the inside of the heel out. So likely the legs straddled the cross with a spike through each heel bone right underneath the part of the heel bone that bears the greatest weight of the body. And that would be very easy to do versus trying to put 1 foot on top of another. That would
yeah.
have been horribly hard for a soldier. And when you put a spike through a live heel bone, it does not break the bone, so keeping with scripture that none of his bones will be broken.
Right. And so you include some technical detail about the space in the hand or the
yes.
arms wherein the spike might have went through. And if done right, it doesn't break any bones, but it also sustains the weight of the individual.
Oh, yeah, because so you think of, if you have heard of carpal tunnel surgery, well, there is a thick fibrous band of cartilage that wraps the 8 wrist bones, which are in 2 rows of 4.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put a spike anywhere near the middle of the wrist, as Dr. Pierre Barbet in his research and Dr. Bevilacqua and others in Italy have shown, it always finds its way between these 4 bones called the space of Destot, named after a French anatomist. Without breaking anything,
mm-hmm.
but because there's that tough cartilage surrounding it, you are fixed firmly, and you're not going to tear through that.
So you end your inquiry on the crucifixion proper by talking about the exercise of priesthood from the cross, and Jesus does this by means of the door that he enters through is the door of his own suffering. And so tell us about that.
Well, what is the essence of priesthood? The essence of priesthood is offering sacrifice on behalf of others for their salvation. And so when we are baptized as priest, prophet, and king too. So in his priesthood, he is both the priest and the sacrifice, the willing sacrifice that could atone for us and for our sins. But now that Christ lives in us after baptism, as long as we're not in a state of mortal sin, we have, the life of Christ within us, we can also offer our suffering to affect eternity, because we can affect someone else's salvation through our acts of offering up.
Mm-hmm.
So really, offering it up is a superpower that can affect eternity, unlike any of these, superheroes you see on TV.
Yeah.
That doesn't affect eternity. We can, and we can do that every day.
So in light of the fact that he is high priest and offering, and he's hanging upon that cross, making himself both. He really is the Passover lamb and the high priest, and also the temple. His body is the temple of the new covenant sacrifice and offering. I want to go back to a quote by Dr. Barbe that you quote in your book, that the major effect of crucifixion has to do with hypovolemic shock. You're looking at asphyxiation because your normative respiration has been greatly hampered and interrupted.
Actually, that's false. I'm doing everything I can in the world to show that there is no evidence for that. I published a peer-reviewed paper a few years ago. Suffocation probably had nothing to do with how crucifixion victims died, but that'd be another haul. But I believe it's with the shock, because when you lose all that fluid and your heart's beating harder, you get into... your pH gets off in acidosis, your chemicals, your potassium and sodium get off. And what can happen then is you can either die of that outright, or it can cause an irregular heartbeat, an arrhythmia, which explains how Jesus could know that he only had minutes left to live. Because if you go into ventricular tachycardia, when the bottom part of the heart starts becoming the pacemaker instead of the top, you start to get, you might get nauseous, you might get pain in your chest, you might get lightheaded, and you know something is wrong. And that would give Jesus enough time to say, I thirst, to say, it is finished, and into your hands I commend my spirit. Because Jesus cries out in a loud voice at the moment of death, which you cannot do if you're suffocating.
Right. So, I brought that up because you seem to be one of the few opponents to the theory. And I will say, a theory as it is, some of your answers to it are rather substantial, especially including the fact that with a loud cry, he delivers his spirit, or as you quote in the scriptures, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit.
Right. And that's it. See, the whole idea for this breathing thing was based on some doctors seeing this punishment or this torture where people's wrists are tied together, either behind them or in front of them. They're hung up, and then they will suffocate in one of those positions if not taken down within half an hour or so. The problem is, that's not crucifixion. In crucifixion, most of the weight is on the feet. In that, all the weight is on the wrists.
Right.
And so there have been studies done by at least two physicians of people on crosses with wrist gauntlets. None of them have trouble breathing. If you look through the ancient literature, there's no examples of people having trouble breathing, going up and down in the cross. But they yell, they spit, they cry, and they can live for days.
Right, exactly. They've been known to live for almost over a week at a time. Tom, I could continue on, but thank you so much for making the time to speak with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Have a blessed Holy Week.
You too. My guest, Dr. Thomas McGovern, he's the author of What Christ Suffered, A Doctor's Journey Through the Passion. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.